Yeah, I'm going to talk about show wild reality for the Clifford Group, and I will give you many applications. And I have a presenter. And yeah, no, let me first thank the one organizer in attendance and also the organizers not in attendance. It's great to be back. I haven't been to PI for a decade. I don't know how I mentioned that. I had fun like yesterday or like the day before yesterday. I had never seen the new extension, so it's great to be here. Okay, so here's my outline. I will tell you what I mean by this. I will give you many applications, and if I have time, I will talk about how duality, which is something I now find extremely fascinating, and I'm sure you will too. And yeah, look, I mean, this is a bit of a technical talk, you know. I want to sell a method. I think there's a method that I've been working on for some time now, and I think it's super, and I think it's there to stay. And I hope I will be able to convince you. And at the moment, I don't think anybody has really used it, and it's maybe partly because our papers are a bit too technical. So the first, or one of the papers, yeah, had two figures and 30 pages per figure, and the pages are typically stuff where we iterated corollaries to get isomorphism. We still have to write this out, I think, in a more accessible way, but I would ask you to bear with me, because I do think it fills a gap, and it will have many applications in quantum information. Okay.
What is the paper?
This paper, that is the... it's called show wild reality for the Clifford group.
and with
applications, indeed. That's what the title says. Right? Right. So I'm consistent here, no?
Yeah, okay.
Good. Okay, so let me first remind you of what show wild reality is. There are some people here who use it extensively. There are some people who might have never heard about it. And so we take some Hilbert space H, and we take the t-th tensor power. And then there's different things one could do with it. For example, we can simultaneously change the basis of all the factors here. And so we can have this diagonal representation of the unitary. The U maps to U to the tensor U to tensor U T times. Yeah, what one can also do is one can take the T systems and permute them in some way with some permutation. And it's clear that these two things commute. Yeah, whether I do this, change the basis everywhere and then shuffle around, or first shuffle around and then do the same thing everywhere, doesn't matter. And show wild reality gives a stronger statement. It says not only do they commute, but essentially everything that commutes with u to the tensor t is a permutation. Yeah, or more generally, a linear combination of permutations. Yeah, and so this is like an algebraic description of the commutant. There is another representation theoretic one, which is a bit more involved. And it says that as a consequence of this commutation relation, you can decompose the tensor power Hilbert space simultaneously into irreps of the symmetric and unitary group, and no multiplicities will occur. The majority of my talk is on this side, which is easier. Our new results are on this side, which are cooler. But I'm not sure I will be able to explain it. There is one aspect of the wild reality whose importance maybe gets a bit underemphasized, and let me emphasize. So there are two things that are nicer than they could have been. Yeah. So we start with this u to the tensor n, and I will work with this diagram a lot. So what I do here is I will now, like the first Hilbert space I started with, I will now also give it an internal structure. So it could be now like n qubits, for example. Yeah, and then I take t copies of these n qubits. Yeah, and then I arrange all these quantum systems in a two-dimensional way. So that is a CD, and then the U's, they act on 2 to the n systems, and then they act the same way, and I have my T copies here. Okay. And so for this U, the commutant is generated again by a group, namely by the permutation group. That is not, I mean, there's no reason to expect why that should be true. This is a big like fortune that we have it. Yeah. And also it is generated by tensor powers. Yeah, because if I have, let's say I have two copies, t equal to 2, if I want to swap n quantum systems, I can swap the first and then the second and the third independently. Right? So the permutations also factorize, and they factorize in kind of this orthogonal manner. So on this two-dimensional array of quantum systems, you have two actions, one acts horizontally, the other acts vertically, and they commute. Yeah. And this will mean we will find the same transversality, we call it transversality, this factorization here. We will also find it for the Clifford group, and it will result in the effect that many of our results are actually independent of n, so that we can give constructions and the performance guarantees will be independent of n, because basically we only have to solve the single qubit problem, and then often we can just tensor power it and get the general solution. So this will give very strong results. Okay, so now what we're going to do today is we're going to ask what happens if one doesn't have the full unitary group, but we restrict to our favorite subgroup that has an official description, that has a special role in resource theories. I'm mentioning that for the benefit of the organizers. In resource theories, what do we have there? Yeah, and obviously, if one group gets smaller, the commutant gets bigger, and we still understand it. So what's the history of that problem? It seems that it is asked in particular in the city of Waterloo. So I will now list the state of the art, and half the references are from people who work here or used to work here. Yeah. So let's say we have t equal to 2, right? So we have two copies of the Clifford group. Then it was shown in the context of analyzing randomized benchmarking back in 2005 by Dankert and Joe Emerson that the commutant doesn't actually change. Yeah, I make the group smaller from the full unitary just to the Clifford, but the commutant doesn't feel that. Yeah, so that's the unitary 2 design property, which is used a lot, for example, as the basis of randomized benchmark. Then a decade later, there were three people who simultaneously published the result that for t to 3, this is also the case. And it was Zach Webb from Perimeter Institute, Yuan Jun Zhu, who worked at Perimeter Institute while he founded it, but moved to my group before he published it, and me and my student. And so, like, my own employee was me, but okay. So, it was good we hired him so we could at least coordinate the release. And so, yeah, there were three papers on the same day on the archive, each cross referencing each other. And a bit later we did the t equal to 4 case. There we see first differences, but they are kind of like mild. And so yeah, so for t equal to 2, 3, and 4, we like manually, for every t, we manually like did some new math and solved. So we submitted them these papers to QIP, and in the t equal to 4 extended abstract, I kind of wrote an apology to the referees of QIP, saying that, look, I will not write like every year of QIP, I will not have a new submission for a new t. So that's going to be the last one. Yeah, sorry?
What happened the year after?
And then the next year we get all t. Yeah, and so, all right, so it's my next slide. So now let's solve the problem for all t, and this was again submitted to QIP. And then, okay, so
are you holding on to it like from the first year?
Right, exactly. When I used to be called Dunker. Okay, so the applications, there are many, and I don't want to go into this at all. The existing applications, randomized benchmarking, decoupling, crypto, variance bounce randomized benchmarking. That's why now people recently went into the T4 regime, blah, blah, blah. I mean, it's like they have many, many applications, but they are old, and I don't want to talk about them because I will try to tell you about some new applications. Okay, so now, of course, now we got like the low cases, and now the next step really is to solve the full problem. Yeah? And there are two versions of the full solution. One is this version where we just want to describe the commutant and give a linear algebraic basis for the commutant. And the other one is the representation theoretic version. And we did both. And at least I want to tell you about one today, and two, let's see how far it is. All right, so, okay. Ta-da! Here's the commutant. So the commutant algebra of the t tensor power of the Clifford group over d to the n. So d can be qubits, can be higher dimensional systems qubits. It's generated again by t tensor powers of now what? So before we had the permutations, and now I need to set that it's bigger than the permutations. So what is bigger than the permutations? And these are these two objects which I will introduce one by one. One is called the stochastic orthogonal transformations, and the other one is called self-orthogonal CSS projections. Okay, let me explain to you what that means. This you probably know, let me tell you how it enters here, and this you probably don't know, so let me define that. Okay, so we need some bunch of operations that are bigger than permutations. And here's one, namely, what is bigger than permutations? Well, for example, rotations. a permutation exchanges coordinates, and the rotation like gradually exchanges coordinates. Yeah, but now we are in a discrete world, so we need some kind of discrete rotation. So how do we get those? And we get them as follows. So we take a T by T matrix, and we put entries in ZD, so for qubit it's a 0-1 matrix, and we demand that we get the normal relation of orthogonal matrices, but it should hold mod D only. So now we got some kind of discrete rotation. We also have this extra condition that the all ones vector should be mapped to itself, so we call this stochasticity. So these are the two conditions that we have. And now with each such object, I associate a Hilbert space operator, which is going to be very easy. So let's go back to this two-dimensional array of systems. So I can now label the basis states in here, the computational basis states, by a matrix, right? Where each element of the matrix tells me which basis state I pick from each of these two-dimensional array of systems. And so on this big matrix of that labels my basis states, I can just act from the left with the C by T matrix. If it's a permutation, then it will permute these rows as we know. And now it's a bit more general, so I can now like rotate these rows into each other. And so these are the stochastic orthogonal transformations. Now, that was the definition. Of course, we have no feeling for these things at all. Let me give you our beloved famous example, which turns out that everything we will do later in the education can all be explained by this. That's a very important object somewhere in the theory. So yeah, we thought about, okay, so we found this class of orthogonal rotations. We wanted to find some examples. And one class of examples are what we call the anti-permutations. So what's the anti-permutation? You take a permutation, and then it's a T by T matrix, and then you change every 1 into a 0, every 0 into a 1. Yeah, and there's some extra conditions, but let me sweep them on the carpet. For example, here is the 6 by 6 anti-identity.
So these the size of the matrix, or are these independent of that?
D?
D, that's some Z here.
That's... right, yeah, that's right. Oh, that is a qubit. Sorry, it's for qubit. Yeah, it's 0, 1, yeah, it's the qubit version, D equals 2. Yeah, and there are some for qubit. There are some extra conditions which are related to Dan Gottesman's talk this morning. Yeah, and your question about like the question about the I, where does the I come from? Yeah, and the I means somehow we have something going on mod 4. And so what we need this matrix to do in addition to like being orthogonal, we needed to preserve Hamming weight mod 4. And the 6 by 6 matrix is Hamming weight 5, which is 1 mod 4. Ha! Okay, so that's why this particular matrix comes about. Anyway. So what does it do if I apply it to a computational basis state? Okay, we have our block again. Now, yeah, because it acts as a matrix multiplication from the left, it acts independently on every column. And so on one column, what it does is it checks, okay, now we have x1 to x6, binary numbers. It checks whether the parity is even, and if the parity is even, it does nothing. And if the parity is odd, it flips all the bits. So that's an operation.
Yeah.
N qubits, 6 copies, and then in every like slice, you flip all the bits if the parity is odd. That's what the NDI does.
Sorry, can you say, what were you saying about the weight mod 4 thing again?
Yeah, my goal is not to get into that at all. On your insistence, I say it once again, but it doesn't really matter for the purpose of this. So there's like for
I thought you said that there was an extra condition, and then you said the matrix doesn't satisfy it.
It doesn't. Yeah, so the extra condition is, so the thing need to be stochastic orthogonal, and in the qubit case, the extra condition is that it preserves Hamming weight mod, Hamming weight mod 4. And so the basis vector is Hamming weight 1. And the image here, these are 6 entries, but 1 is 0, so it has Hamming weight 5, which is 1 mod 4. So there we go.
Okay.
But it is completely unnecessary, and I didn't put it on my slides because absolutely I don't want to talk about Hamming weight mod 4. Yeah? But I want to like talk about this like curious rotation that kind of flips every bit if the parity is odd.
What is X bar?
Oh, or the average, yeah. Yeah, it's like. So how do I see that this bit flipping description is right? So what this does is it basically computes the average, or like sums them all up, but you subtract the one on the diagonal. So that's why I get this 4. Yeah?
Should I be worried that you might not be able to divide by the dimension?
Yeah, it's not the average, it's the sum of all of them.
Oh, okay.
So stick with my, forget, don't look at the math I write, look at the words I write. Yeah? It flips a bit if the parity is odd, okay? So that's what it does, yeah. Okay? Right. So now, why? What would one be able to do yet? Yeah, why does anybody care about this matrix? I will give you in my applications list, I will tell you what fancy thing the thing can do. Yeah, there's a second ingredient, which I don't need to introduce to this audience at all, I think, but let me anyway just briefly mention it for the sake of completeness. Namely, we need self-orthogonal CSS codes. Yeah, and what we do is we take a subset of n of z b to the t, and we demand that the usual canonical inner product on that set vanishes, and then with this I can associate a Poisson code, yeah, where with every element u of n I have an x type operator, a z type operator, and if I compute the commutation relation, I get exactly this inner product, which is zero, so they commute, so I get a quantum code.
Why is there an x and a z type operator?
Why is there an x and a z type operator?
You have types of type.
What's a typo?
Huh?
You said
it's z. Oh, there's a, because that is a z. Don't look at the math I write, listen to the words I say. Yeah, okay.
I close my eyes.
Right, in particular because I can't really see from it, it's a bit of an unfair question. Okay, so it's a CSS, but you know what a CSS code is, so I don't know why I'm even like talking about it. Okay, so now I can go back to the results here, and it says, okay, so what we have is, again, we have like a transversal structure like this. Again, we have the n-cuted Clifford group acting horizontally, and we have t copies of it. Yeah, and then the commutant is spanned by to every block of t qubits. Yeah, you either have either choose one stochastic orthogonal matrix and apply it to all of them, or you choose a CSS code projection and apply it to all of them. Okay, I hope you're appropriately impressed. Yeah, let's try to get some feeling for what that means. Yeah. Oh, Robert, you look very unhappy.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I'm just wondering how is the action of a unitary can be? Why? How can it be reproduced by the action of a projection?
No, it's the commute. No. So if you first project.
Oh, so it's just the matter of order. Okay.
Yeah. It doesn't matter. The order doesn't matter. Okay, so it's again transversal, which is great, and which will like be the basis of all of our results. Again, there was no reason to expect that. It's not quite a group, the generators here, because we got these CSS code projections in there, so we have some deviation from being a group. This was a bit of a nuisance in the first paper, but it turned out actually to explain some failure of what is called finite Hauer duality, which was an open problem in the 70s. And again, if I have time, I'll tell you what it is. Yeah, okay. Right, so this was all completely bizarre. There's funky matrices coming out of nowhere. Let me now tell you what to do with it. And here's a long list of applications, and my premise is that, if you all know about these techniques, you'll find your own applications soon enough. So one is the realization that stabilizer states have an additional symmetry that seems to not have been noticed before. So I take some stabilizer state and tensor power of n qubits and take again t-fold tensor power of it. So before these were Clifford operations, now it's stabilizer states. And now it turns out that they are invariant obviously under permutations, but they're also invariant under all our orthogonal stochastic things. So tensor powers of stabilizer states have an additional symmetry. Yeah, you rotate them, you rotate each of these vertical stripes into each other, and then still it's going to be the same. Yeah, I don't know, for example, you check some stabilizer state, can be entangled, can be complex, whatever. Yeah, and then on every qubit, you flip the bits if the parity is odd, you see back the stabilizer state. That is certainly unexpected. The proof is very simple. The proof is because, that's a very simple proof. Yeah? They're very good. Thank you. Okay, all right. So now, what can we use this for? And two things. One is this stabilizer testing problem in the feed into your stabilizer rank problem on the next slide.
Sorry, that operation you keep mentioning is unitary?
This anti-ID?
Yes.
Yeah, that actually is unitary, yeah. Because why?
So let me go back. It's unitary because the action I introduce here.
Yeah. And you can see it's just a fancy permutation of the computational basis space. It's not a permutation of systems, but it is a permutation of space.
So because it's a regular space.
Very simple. Okay, so now we have an additional overlooked symmetry of stabilizer states. Now stabilizer testing. Here's a problem that thankfully Ashley Montanaro posted as an open problem some years ago. Oh, you want to say?
Yeah, sorry, a different question. So the claim you just made, these need to be the same CSS state, not like...
These states need to be the same, yeah. Not CSS, they don't need to be CSS. These are just an arbitrary stabilizer states. Yeah, and you take a t-fold tensor power, and then any of these funky orthogonal rotations keep them invariant. A similar statement is known for Gaussian states. So I don't know whether you know this. There's old papers on extremality of Gaussian states by Sirac and Wolf and people, and they use similar techniques for Gaussian states.
So like if these were code states.
If these were not pure states but codes.
Code.
Asking, yeah, it would also be true.
It would also be.
Yeah.
You remain in the code.
Yes. And you can use. It's not anywhere written up, but if you try to like generalize this extremity of Gaussian states using this language, you kind of like take a density matrix and you will map it to, the largest code, the largest stabilizer code, that contains the support of the density operator. So you can have generalizations of this from states to stabilizer codes.
And T must be at least 6 in this case.
And this invariant is always true. Yeah, but sometimes there are states that are invariant that are not stabilizer states. And now the 6 will turn out on my next slide to be the lowest power for which this invariant is only fulfilled by stabilizer states, by no others. Yeah.
Okay.
Right. Okay. So. Here's an application which solves a problem that Ashley Montanaro put up in the context of quantum property testing. And the problem was this: somebody prepares for you a number of copies of an unknown pure quantum state, and you have to decide is it a stabilizer or not.
Yeah. And
now, if you have log squared n or whatever, then by a result of Scott Aronson while he was in Waterloo. Yeah, you can just do tomography and find it and check whether it's stabilizer state. But if you have, let's say you have only a constant number of copies, but n is allowed to be arbitrarily big, can you then somehow, is there some physical procedure for recognizing stabilizer states? And there is, and here's the answer. Yeah, so. Yeah, you take 6 copies, you check for this invariant, you check, am I in a +1 eigenstate of the anti-ID? And I accept if yes, and I reject if no. And if far is indeed a stabilizer, the procedure will accept its probability 1. And if it is far away from every stabilizer, then the acceptance probability will go down with an optimal rate. As a function of how far away you are. And the thing to notice is that this result does not depend on n. Yeah, and that is a result of this transversality that we mentioned. Yeah, and if you want to like phrase it differently, it means there is a polynomial function of order 12 that takes the value 1 on every stabilizer state and is strictly smaller than 1 and in fact uniformly bounded away from 1 on non-stabilizer states. So if you want, it's a polynomial set of polynomial equations that single out stabilizer states. And can have similar versions for Clifford and so on. Okay. And here's another application that fits the theme of the workshop. I will come to you with that in a second. So this also connects. I said, okay, it's like time for me to like go back into the past. Yeah, 10 years ago I was here at PI, enjoyed myself tremendously. Yeah, even before that, my first ever paper was to characterize those pure states that have a non-negative Wigner function. Yeah, and what we can do now is we can, using the same tricks, we can revisit that and have a stable version. Yeah. And so what we said back then is, if a Wigner function is non-negative and the state is pure, then the state must be a stabilizer. Now we can say, if the state is pure and the Wigner function has small negativity, then it's close to a stabilizer. So we take some negativity, of course, also the function studied in resource theory and in Waterloo in particular. And the distance to the next stabilizer, the closest stabilizer state, is small if the sum negativity is small. And again, it's n independent. So it's another application of this. Then it's my favorite application, which I don't have an application of the application of yet. So using these techniques, I can prove something which I find fantastic, but I don't know what to use it for. So it's a definite theorem. It's an exponential definite theorem. Yeah. So what you know is, yeah. So there's this important line of work by many people that symmetry implies independence. Yeah. If you let me make a statement. So we have a state psi. Here it's Q on the slide, but it can also be mixed. And let's say it is invariant not just under permutations, but it's invariant under this bigger group of formal stochastic matrices. Yeah. And then I take a subset of my states and trace them out. And it turns out that the remaining systems are in a mixed state that is in a mixture of stabilizer states. Yeah, so again, let me remind you what the normal definite is. If you have a commutation invariant density matrix, yeah, and you trace out a few systems, then the remainder is a convex combination of tetra powers. Yeah. We have the same, but now with the convex combination is in terms of stabilizer states. So if you know the symmetry, you have this stabilizer independence. Yeah. And the convergence is exponential, which is much better than the usual definite theorems, which have a convergence, the one norm error goes down with one over the number of systems you trace out, yes. Exponential, yeah, which in the normal case you have to relax your notion of approximation. Here we don't have to do it. So,
isn't that so much better?
It's a very strong symmetry, I don't know. Very strong symmetry. Mm-hmm.
So psi here is any state.
This is any state. Yeah, it can be mixed. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. And there's actually it's very unfortunate that Anthony had to leave like an hour ago because there's some kind of Gaussian version of this. Anthony Leverrier proved a number of years ago, and here's the discrete version of that. And he proved it in the context of continuous variable QKD. And I was always hoping to find some QKD application for this. I haven't found one yet, so if you're into that, please talk to me.
Do you know if the original state is in some sense far from being a stabilizer state in the first place, or is it? Are you saying that?
It could be, yeah. It could be. I have no idea. I just assume it's like you see. It's like in the normal definite. You know, they are states that are permutation variant, but are far away from being tensor power, like a mixture of tensor powers. Yeah, and you could have the same thing.
But you did say before that if you knew that this was a bunch of copies, only a stabilizer state.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. This can be
entangled.
This can be mixed in particular. Yeah. And we didn't have that before. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, now stabilizer rank. David Gossett, who's not here, and Earl and their collaborators, they want to find minimal number of copies of stabilizer state. So they take a magic state, they take a tensor power of the magic state, and then want to write it as a linear combination of stabilizer states. So how many terms do you need? Right. But so there's one bound in the paper, and this one bound in the paper uses our result. Yeah, and by the stabilizer testing that I mentioned before, using the same method, you can show that the powers of the stabilizer states, yeah, if you take all the stabilizer takes and take the t-th power, then these states span the totally symmetric space up to t equal to 5, but not from 6 onwards. Yeah, the fact that it fails for 6 onwards is just what the stabilizer testing uses. Yeah, but for up to 6, for up to five, you can't really distinguish between an average t tensor power of any pure state and a t tensor power of a stabilizer state. Yeah, and from this argument, you can, if you have like any psi, maybe a magic state, you take the fifth tensor power. Yeah, you ask what is the stabilizer rank? Well, it is certainly symmetric. And the stabilizers form a basis of a symmetric space. So you can upper bound it by the dimension of the symmetric space, which is 6, much better than 32. And in this diagram we showed, how this is...
the world's least convincing exponential.
Sorry?
The world's least convincing exponential.
Exactly, yeah, that's right. And I think like the initial plateau where things are not really exponential, no, these come from arguments like this. Yeah. And so my initial hypothesis at the beginning of the talk was I'm trying to advertise a method, and I think that if people knew more about it, you were using it. And so it seems like that's the first proof. No people learning about the method and then using it. So I have to admit that I have a good authority that the referee of the paper had to remind you of the facts for version 2. So I think there could be more advertisement could be made. All right, save by the rank. That's right. And here's an application I was talking before with Debbie. She asked me about this, which is partly published and partly ongoing. I will first talk about the published part, and then I will make some vague references to the ongoing work, which is a very cool thing. Okay, so it's about this notion of T designs. What's a T design? Where some of you get very excited about this. You know? The finite set of points, for example, on a sphere, that is evenly distributed in the sense that that if you sample random points from that arrangement, you get the same t-th moment as if you sampled a random vector from the sphere. Yeah, and designs have many applications. Yeah, there's a version for unitaries where you don't want to approximate the sphere but the set of unitaries. In any case, what we should, yeah, because it is known that the Clifford group is a free design. So up to order 3, you can get designs made out of Clifford unitaries or made out of Clifford orbits. Yeah, but it's also clear that if you go to higher T, then you can't have this anymore. You have to have some non-Clifford resources you have to put in. And now the main result here is that because of this transversality, the amount of non-Cliffordness you need is independent of n. Yeah, so one manifestation which is in our paper is, yeah, one can construct an exact T design from a number of Clifford orbits that does not depend on n. Yeah, and somehow very little beyond Clifford is needed.
How many?
Yeah, it depends on T, and there's a formula in the paper, and the dependence on T is not necessarily pretty, but for any fixed C, it does not depend on N. So it is for the limited T and large N limit where this becomes different. Now there's a second result, which maybe I shouldn't really talk about yet, because it's in the process of being written up, and in fact only works since Monday. It's a unitary version of that. And so if you, it's with the Isaac group, there's this long list of papers that if you take a random circuit, yeah, and then the random circuit will converge to a T design if you make it long enough. Yeah, but then random circuits, they are formally efficient, but even like random two qubit gates, of course, are difficult to do. So that's not random circuits, that's two Clifford, random Clifford gates. Now, random Clifford gates can't work because the Clifford group fails to be a four design. Yeah, and so you will have to add a few number of non-Clifford gates. How many? Well, it scales in T, it scales in epsilon if it's approximate, but it does not scale in N. Yeah, so that's, I think it's very cool. No, you can have a T design of any order, for any number of qubits with a number of non-Clifford resources that is independent of the number of qubits. Again, so in terms of resources, yeah, Clifford is almost there. Okay, this is coming out soon, I hope. Right.
Do you only ever look at adding T gates? Do you ever look at adding something else that's non-Clifford?
No. We have not looked at this, but it is. Yeah, I think the important thing is, of course, the end independence. It's not really time to
hear.
Yeah. Okay, so then this is the summary here. We have found the commutant of the tensor powers of the Clifford group, and there's many applications. And so that is cool. Now I have basically no time anymore, no? And I could tell you about how duality, or I could discuss with you guys. What do you say? How much time is there left?
You can take maybe 5 to 7 more minutes.
Oh, 5 minutes. Okay. Like, because it's so cool, I will quickly walk you through it. And if you understand nothing, then I apologize. It will not help you if you read the paper, because it solves some problem that mathematicians were thinking about. So we try to imitate their language. So it's a very, very mathy. And I kind of can't understand anymore, like 3 months after we put it on the archive. And we're going to write a physics follow-up, and then everything will be fine. All right. So the basic realization is, so we sat down and like found these orthogonal things and we're happy. And then later we found that in the continuous variable case, it was all long known and has been known since the 1970s and was discovered by Roger Tau, who became famous with this in the 1970s. This is important why I tell you this, I will come back to that. And so we do the exact same thing, but now every dot here is now an L2 of R, it's now a harmonic oscillator. And then now I have n harmonic oscillators, and of course you all know there's these canonical transformations, the symplectic group acting on it. No, some people call it the metaplectic representation, like squeezing operations in quantum optics. Yeah, and we can ask the exact same question, namely if I take n modes and t copies, and I apply the same whatever squeezing operations to all of them. Yeah, what is the commutant of this? Right. And it's the continuous orthogonal group. Yeah, the T by T normal orthogonal matrix, like the normal orthogonal matrices, like you've always known them. Yeah? And it's exactly the same. And again, the reason is the same is because here you have the representation theoretic analog that I briefly mentioned for the Schur-Weyl, which means you can decompose the tensor power as simultaneously under the orthogonals that mix modes and the symplectic operations, and it will be multiplicity free and all of them will be irreducible. Okay, so now it so happened that in the 1970s, when Howe published it, before he published that, he tried to do the thing for finite groups. And it failed, it didn't work. So you can now, I will now make a little trick, I will like go to the like superimpose the continuous and the finite theory, and you see everything stays the same, except for this representation theoretic part doesn't work anymore. No, the classification theorem fails. You do no longer have a 1-1 correspondence between EVF of the group, and so that's why Howe like never published it, and became world famous with his continuous theory. Okay, and so what we can now do is using quantum information ideas, like reduce out these things. And it's to a quantum information audience, it's completely obvious what the answer is. All right. Yeah, okay, so now to go faster, reducible. It was known since the 70s. And then, yeah, we were made aware of this by a paper by Shamgar Gurevich and Roger Howe from 2016, which is remarkable because it's the same Howe who got famous in the 1970s, and he's now 80 or whatever and still working on that. Okay, and now we can reduce it out, but let me fast forward a bit and let me tell you why as a quantum information audience you could have guessed what the problem was all along. Okay. So now, okay, I have to do a little, tiny little bit of representation theory. So here is an abelian subgroup of the symplectic group. Let me try to break it down for you. So the small symplectic group is 2 by 2, yeah, and then you have these off-diagonal matrices, like 1, 1, 0, and something here. In like classical mechanics, that describes the time evolution of a free particle. Yeah, the momentum stays the same, and the position gets increased by something proportional to the momentum. Yeah, so that's a free particle. Yeah. And because like 2 time steps of a free particle, that's abelian. Yeah, it goes twice as fast and twice the time. So it's an abelian subgroup of the symplectic group. Okay, thank you, Lord. Far or fast, whatever I say. Okay, now let's go back to higher dimension. So all these blocks are now n by n blocks. Now it's still true, this abelian substructure. And now you all know, of course, that if you have an abelian group, then you can decompose the representation space into one-dimensional representations. And on every like one-dimensional array, the representation will just be a complex phase. And the complex phase will now depend on A in a linear way, and every linear function of A I can write as phase AB. Okay, so with every one-dimensional EREP, I can now associate a matrix B. Now, they defined, Gurevich and Howe, 3 years ago, they defined the rank of a representation to be the maximal rank of any B, that occurs this way. That is bizarre. Again, let me tell you what B is for the Clifford group, which is a representation of the symplectic group. Yeah, at least for odd, I will not distinguish. Okay, so let's look at the t equal to 1 case. And then let's remember what Dan Gottesman told us. For t equal to 1, you got these quadratic phases. Yeah, and they are just a representation of these matrices. And quadratic phases I can write as trace A with these outer products. Yeah, and that's a rank 1 matrix. So the Clifford group is a rank 1 representation of the symplectic group. And if I have tensor powers of the Clifford representation, yeah, then I will add, I have not just x, but I have x1, x2, x3, and I will add up these outer products, so I will get a rank t matrix. Yeah, so there we are. Yeah, so we have found a nice invariant of representations that we can understand. And now what they showed in 2017 is that the following picture. They said that like these things, they were reducible. Yeah, that was the problem all along. But they said in this reducible space, there is one unique rank T E-rep. So now the picture is like this. So you take the big space, you reduce it out, you have an orthogonal representation, and then you have the biggest chunk somehow of the symplectic one, which is the unique rank T part that they showed in 27 exists. Now the problem is you've identified the biggest chunk, but where there's chunk, there's also junk. Yeah, there are lower rank representations that make the thing reducible, which don't appear in the continuous variable case, and they couldn't say anything about the junk. And now it's time for the physicists to clean up. Yeah. Right? And now here is, so now the question is, where do rank deficient reps representations come from? And now comes the quantum information part. Yeah? So somehow we have to embed lower tensor powers into higher tensor powers. And how do we do it? Using coding theory, obviously. No? That's what a transversal quantum code does. Yeah? Let's say we have few qubits, we embed them into many qubits, and then on many qubits we have a transversal action such that the action on many qubits is the same as the action on few qubits. Yeah, what this does is it takes a high rank representation and turns into a low rank representation. So now we have to find a code that allows the entire Clifford group as a transversal gate. Cool, huh?
Wow.
Self-orthogonal CSS codes, exactly. That's what self-orthogonal CSS codes do, right? And so these were the self-orthogonal CSS codes that we had found before. And that's exactly then right. Yeah, so we take all these like singular spaces, we do the self-orthogonal CSS codes, and we find that if I restrict the T tensor power to the self-orthogonal CSS code, I get one that is equivalent to an S to a power S where S is smaller, namely it is reduced by 2 times the dimension of N. Yeah, and so we find like some pieces of the junk we can now explain by CSS codes, and then of course the cool theorem is that this is all. Yeah. So all rank deficient subrepresentations arise this way. So what like little Howie was missing in the 1970s was a good old theory of transversal actions on self-orthogonal CSS codes. Really could have come up, no? Right, and now we can work this out. Blah, blah, blah. And I summarize. Wait, what? Thank you.
So, sorry, I want to make a quick comment on the exact result that the Clifford group is a 2D sign, and the fact that you can say you from the Clifford group, you have the competence is from the implementation group with 2 elements. That was first proved in 2001 in the quantum data hardening paper by myself, David Chancellor, and Barbara Tucker.
I'm very sorry, Debbie. I will add many citations. Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sorry.
Because the author in the 2005 paper forgot to put that into the paper initially. That's why everyone spread that.
Right, okay. So then I can blame them. But really, I should blame myself because, of course, I know all your randomization papers. And I failed to realize it's in there. So, thanks.
Sorry, just in the continuous case,
yeah.
What it says is that I have a row of oscillator, an array of oscillator,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then I can apply any Gaussian transformation on the rows,
yeah.
And that will commute with any mode transformation on the columns. Is that right?
Right. So I'm not quite sure so the question is mode transformations.
Yes, it's like you're, isn't that right?
So the type of operation that we have in the mixing is in the symplectic picture is like this. It's O zero zero, right? O zero zero, right? O is an element of the orthogonal group of T. There's a different orthogonal group flying around here, namely there's U of T, yeah, which is isomorphic to SPT intersect O of 2T. You know, these are the passive linear optical transformation that's a distinct subgroup from this one, even though the orthogonal appears in both. I
is this like the distinction between Bogoliubov and this mode transformation?
Sitting here like during the lunch break, I was anticipating the question might come, and I was trying to work it out, and I didn't so quickly. I don't know, my quantum optics is not good enough. I don't know, Terry, do you know? Can you like identify these orthogonal groups? Oh, it's not even. Oh, hi, Sam. Sam. Where did I think you were like, you were Terry? I don't know. You have a similar hairstyle. You have a similar hairstyle and a similar colored shirt. So wait, let me fix it for you. Sam, do you know? All right. So I know I have to. Yeah, it's so I forgot what the.
It's not Gaussian on rows and Gaussian.
Yeah, it is Gaussian on rows and Gaussian on columns, but like exactly which Gaussian there are on the columns, I can tell you like in the like linear algebra picture, I know it, but the quantum optical representation, I have to look up myself. Yeah, Sam, you could have really prepared it better. Yeah.
I have a question about the bit where you were saying that if you have a Clifford group and you add some small number of gates,
yeah,
then you end up with a T design. Yeah, so
I want to say you take a random circuit,
yes,
that's composed of Cliffords and a number of keys that does not scale with the number of the qubits.
Yes.
Yeah. Then randomly sampling from this is the same as randomly sampling from a unitary key design, like epsilon approximation.
Okay. Let's say that I replace the T gates with something else.
Yeah.
And I don't even know what that something else is.
Right.
It's a non-Clifford unitary.
Yeah.
Can I infer something backwards? So if I maybe phrase it in terms of states, right?
Yeah.
So if I take some state and I calculate the Clifford orbit of it, and then I ask, is this a projecting T design? And if it is, then can I conclude that the state was sufficiently far away from being a stabilized state or something?
I think this must be the hardest possible way for certifying that something is not a stable state, but sure, yes, of course. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, but if you can lower bound the stabilizer, right? If it's a way to do that, then you can't do that any other way. So that's what I'm kind of.
Yeah, but then you should do other things. So, like, let me go back to stabilizer ring. So, right. So for the stabilizer ring, So like using our existing paper, we could like we understood the theory up to 6 because that's where stabilizer testing sets in,
yeah.
And then we were no longer interested in the higher powers. That's also why we could only make statements like 4 or 5, and we knew it failed for 6. But what we can now do with like this Hauer duality, we can now actually reduce out these spaces. So we could just like reduce out the totally symmetric subspace in terms of like stabilizer powers and the Clifford representations, and check what we find. I have no idea what the answer would be, but. But certainly, because stabilizer rank is
asking about the opposite thing. I'm asking about lower bounding stabilizer rank. It's like if you take
right.
something and you
yeah.
somehow computed what the Clifford orbit of it was, and you found that it was close to a
yeah. Maybe I want to say that. I mean, stabilizer rank is obviously a Clifford invariant quantity, so it's natural to look for Clifford invariant tests, and this is what the theory can give you. And I think now, like of all the applications that all kind of like depend on Cliffordness and non-Cliffordness, I think you pick the one that is probably the hardest one to construct a witness out of. It's logically possible, but it's not maybe the first thing that we look for. Just look directly for the representation theory and see what you can do. Where by you, I could mean me, for example.
Do you have any idea what kind of logical gate you get by applying this?
Yeah, so it is. There was this talk at QRP in Delft, no, where there was a classification of gates that span a subset of the Clifford group, no? There was remember that? In any case, so there was like, okay, fine. I have to look up the details too. But I remember I was sitting in the talk, and they were classifying all the subsets of gates that would close and not give you everything. Yeah. And then one of the gates that they found in their analysis was a 6x6 matrix with like ones, many ones, but zeros on the. On the main diagonal. So certainly it's like Luke somebody in the author, no? If you look at the QIP Delft program, and they were talking, so it was a good fit. Yeah, so certainly they have some opinions about that. Yeah. But I don't know.
Any other questions? Let's thank David and everyone from this afternoon, gentlemen.